And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
One of my challenges is trying to determine what topics make the cut each week. And during the week, there are some that rise to the top and then make their way to the bottom. But in today's podcast, I'm going to focus on four interesting topics to me. One is probably the best table of investment returns that I look at each year, and it's the Callan periodic table, and I'll focus on that. And as a matter of fact, there is a link to this table, and it might be helpful to go ahead and download that, print it, and be looking at it to the extent that you can as I go through that. Another topic I'm going to cover is why the change in the thrift savings plan going from 50-50 U.S. international to 70-30 U.S. international. I've had a lot of people ask why that change. I'll also talk about the change from the Guggenheim small cap value, the pure small cap value, to the Spider S&P small cap value. And I think you'll find that of interest because we do make changes from time to time. We don't want to make any more than are necessary because we know there are costs. But we have to take into consideration the psychology of the investor as well as the numbers. And so I'll talk about, in this particular case, we think a lot of it has to do with psychology rather than the statistics behind these two ETFs. And finally, I'm going to spend a minute and compare some results of market timing and buy and hold, real results after all expenses over a decade. I have made the case for years that the unit of return per unit of risk is about the same with buy and hold and timing. It's just the timing is a heck of a lot more work. But I'll talk about that real time actually looking at my own portfolio. So let me start with the Callan periodic table of investment returns. We've downloaded this for you before in an article, and I've talked about it on an earlier podcast. But each year, Callan updates this particular table. They've got a whole bunch of other tables that they do, and I'll talk about those when I get done with this one, because this is the one I always find most interesting. But they're looking at returns going back at this point to 1998, so it's a 20-year period. They show 10 asset classes, and by the way, each asset class is given a color. So if you looked at this whole page of all these asset classes, you could see how these returns per asset class relative to others go up and down. So imagine 1998 as an example. Again, 10 different asset classes. At the top of the list is the S&P 500 Growth Index. And by the way, in 1998, up 42.16%. At the bottom of the list is an emerging markets, MSCI Emerging Markets Index, down 25.34. And in between there, we have the S&P 500. By the way, that 500 is a combination of growth and value. We have the World MSCI ex-US, large cap international. We have the S&P 500 Value Index. We have the Bloomberg Barclays Aggregate Bond Index, a High Yield Index, the Russell 2000. These are small companies, the growth-oriented. the Russell 2000, that's a blend of growth and value, the Russell 2000 value, and as I mentioned at the bottom of the list, emerging markets. So I can see over this whole 20-year period, if I want to, how did any particular asset class do? And I can also, because I have this tendency to look for clusters, see when something has been really good for many years, and then to see what happens to that. And I ask myself, gosh, is there any way I could have seen the run for emerging markets from 2003 through 2007? I mean, listen to these returns, up 56, up 26, up 34, up 32, up 39. Not so different, by the way, from the S&P 500 from 1995 to 99, where it compounded at over 28% a year for a five-year period. So this was a huge run for emerging markets. And it's not like it was the first time it had been on the top of the list. In fact, over this 20-year period, there were 9 years that emerging markets were number one, the very best. Of course, we have to look at the other side of that highly productive asset class, because turns out in 6 of the 20 years, it was the very worst. And 1 year it was second from the worst. So it either had generally very, very good returns or very, very bad returns. Now, can you think of any way that those really great returns and really bad returns might work out okay for you? As a matter of fact, better than average. And that would be, if it doesn't come to mind immediately, that if you're rebalancing, if you're taking money from the most productive and putting it into the least productive, there are going to be times when that emerging markets is going to be soaking up lots of money because they've been the worst, only to turn around and be the best. Like 2008, they were the worst. They were down 53%. So I'm guessing that at the end of 2008, you probably had to take some money out of these asset classes that did a lot better, only to have emerging markets come back the next year up 78.5%. So there is some advantage potentially when you can get these wild swings. Of course, what you're hoping for is that the trend over the long term is going to be up. So this is a great presentation. And by the way, I think it's really interesting that they break out the growth versus the value so that you could see that, for example, in 1998, growth was, as I mentioned before, number one, up 42%+. S&P 500 value only up 14.7%. Now, they're both part of that big blend. They're both big companies. But those that were growth-oriented, for whatever reason, were very attractive to the public. And it turned out the next year wasn't all that bad either. The growth up 28%. And the value only up 12.7. Huge differences in that return. Now, you know what kinds of reaction investors have. When one thing has been outproducing something else, they come to the conclusion that this is a permanent relationship. And of course, it turned out it wasn't a perfect permanent relationship, because in 2000 and 2001, value, well, small cap value was number one in 2 years that the market did poorly. Remember, 2000 and 2001 were years that the market went down. At least that's the feeling that we have. and yet the Russell 2000 value was up 22.8 in 2000 and up 14% in 2001, and large cap actually did, the value did okay, while growth did poorly, right down towards the bottom of the page. And I don't know what all the lessons are you might pick up from this page, but I think you might come to the conclusion it's darn hard to try to figure out what's going to happen next. Because it's obvious when we look at this page that there are periods that small do very well and then they don't. And large do well and then they don't. And growth does well and then they don't. And the challenge we have is we don't know when they will and when they won't. Now, it's true. It's true that we could look at the past and see what asset classes were at or near the top most of the long-term historical periods. And as I've talked before, value has tended to float to the top, but it can be down and very dirty when it's out of favor. I mean, I look at 2007, and the Russell 2000 value was the worst of the bunch, small cap value. Well, wait a minute, this is the asset class that makes the most money in the long run. And it wasn't any good, in relatively good in 2009. And it wasn't very good in 2011. And it wasn't very good in 2015. And it wasn't very good in 2017. So along with something that makes a particular asset class very productive for the long term, we as investors have to be ready for some long periods of underperformance. Now, this 20-year period starts in 1998. So what you don't see is that from 1995 to 1999, as I mentioned before, the S&P 500, this is the blend of growth and value, that blend was pretty close to the top, the best, 28.5% compound rate of return for 5 years. But then I look, 2001, I'm sorry, let's see, yeah, 2001, 2, 3, and 4, they were one of the worst. They weren't the worst, but they were one of the worst. And I think it's also interesting to note, if you looked at equity asset classes only, remember I mentioned in 1998 that the top-ranked asset class was S&P 500 growth, up 42 approximately, and emerging markets was down 25. And then the next year, emerging markets number one, up almost 67%, and Russell 2000 value, small cap value, this asset class we love, was down 1.5%. Then in 2000, top of the heap is Russell 2000 value. At the bottom of the heap is emerging markets. Russell 2000 up almost 23, and the emerging market down almost 31. I mean, this could drive a person nuts if they really were trying to second guess, where should I be next? And so as you know, what I'm an advocate of is to find a group of asset classes that have a very long history of success. Diversify amongst those asset classes. I think rebalancing annually is plenty. Even if you went out 18 months, I wouldn't be opposed to it, to minimize the work that you have to do. But take advantage of all of these as they float to the top, and then others will float as they have sunk previously to the bottom. They'll come back up. That is the history of the stock market. Now, of course, What we want to do is we want to stay away from asset classes that don't have a history of good performance. Now, there is an asset class here that I can see that doesn't look all that good. As a matter of fact, let's see. They are the worst performing asset class 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times. And then if we looked at the next lineup, they were second to the worst 2 or 3 times. This asset class, in some ways, is the best asset class on the page. And it's the bond index. Well, why is it worst? Well, it's worst in so many years because we don't own bonds to make a lot of money. We own bonds to be stable. So when I see those years, they were worst. They were up 4, up 4, up 2.5, up 4.3, up 6, up 6, approximately up 4, up 3, and up approximately 3. In every case, they were up, and they were the bottom. In those same years that they were at the, in the years they were at the top, and they did make it to the top, they were years like 2002, up over 10. 2008, remember the year that the market took everything went down in the equities arena. Even high-yield bonds went down 26%. But the bond index, the higher quality, up 5%. 2011, up, and number one now, bonds, up 7.8. So I think there's lots of good lessons for us to drag out of this. And I want you to know that there, if you go to the Callan.com, Callan.com, you'll find this periodic table of investment returns. And they have a whole bunch of other tables of investment returns. And I think that one you might actually find quite interesting is the Callan periodic table of real asset returns, including farmland and timberland and commodities and master limited partnerships. Terrific to see how even timberland, the value of timberland goes up and down. The one that hasn't shown much spark, as a matter of fact, in 6 of the 10 years, they only show 10 years, not 20, commodities were the worst asset, real asset class. And in fact, in 2008, commodities, remember commodities, we look to go up when the market goes down. Remember that? It doesn't correlate, they say. Well, that index was down 36% in 2008. They also have a table of U.S.-only asset classes that go beyond these very basic classes here than the periodic table. They have one for international only, and they have one for fixed income. So I hope that you'll spend some time looking at that and maybe put it on your calendar that midway through each December you'll look up the Callan periodic table and see what's new, what was hot, and what was not. And I enjoy this so much, I'll probably do a podcast on it each year. Now I want to address this question about the change in the balance between U.S. and international equities in the 401k plans. Now, I commenting on the 401k plans, because that is a very different project for us compared to building the portfolios at Vanguard and Fidelity, the ETF portfolios at Schwab and TD Ameritrade and others. I want to compare these two kind of projects, the mutual fund and ETF portfolios versus the 401k. My hope is, in the long run, I will find a number of people who are attracted to our work because it's numbers, statistic-based information. Portfolios put together using lots of evidence from the past, what works and what doesn't work, and what has the highest probability of success for you, and then try hard to give you the guidance to figure out how much in fixed income and how much in equity. And if you notice, looking at the Vanguard, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, and all the other portfolios that we've got there, they are basically set up to be 50-50 U.S. and international. Now, that comes after you've read a lot of material. In fact, my hope is that you will have all each year had some interest in my update of the ultimate buy and hold strategy. And so you know why I want to add these different asset classes and why I don't want to play favorites. You know that I include the S&P 500 in that portfolio, even though I don't think it's going to be the most profitable asset class for you. I have large cap international blend in the portfolio, even though I know it's going to be a drag on long-term performance. But it represents a good asset class, large cap blend, that represents higher quality companies than small cap value or emerging markets, etc. So I think people who follow the advice that I give, using the Vanguard portfolios and the other portfolios, you understand why I have chosen, we have chosen, to use a 50-50 U.S. and international split. But in the whole relative level of education, I'm putting you up pretty close to the top of what people know and understand about investing. I'm talking about retail amateur investors. I feel once they get through my work and Swedrow's work and other people, Wade Fowle and others in the business, that you know a lot about this and would understand the reason that we would build these portfolios that are kind of complex for a lot of people. As you know, it's not easy to rebalance every year. And so I'm asking more than I would expect out of the average investor. But when I and we reach out to people who are Microsoft employees and they have a 401k, and we want to try to help them in terms of building a portfolio that would serve them well for the long term, or lots of the thrift savings plan with the U.S. government, I like to believe that tens of thousands of people someday will follow our advice in order to get a better return. Now, there are some problems with these 401k plans, and they're not insignificant. And the problem, the main problem is, whoever puts them together does not know a lot about the asset classes that can be used to build a broadly diversified portfolio. Or put another way, most of the trustees evidently believe in cap-weighted portfolios. So, for example, they would think that if you had the total market index, that you have a little bit of small cap there, and that's all you really need. Well, we'd like to believe that that may be all you need, but that you would be served if you upped the exposure to small cap, upped the exposure to value. And in some cases, there just are but a handful of choices for an investor to decide where to put their money. And in many cases, we get stuck with a large cap blend, a small cap blend, a large cap international blend, maybe an emerging market, not a small cap international, not even a large cap international value, but somebody has said, okay, let's get really big companies and let's get emerging markets, and that's what we're going to offer people. So what do we know about the people who are going to follow our advice? And how careful do we have to be with them that we don't kind of scare them off, make it so complex that they don't want to deal with it? And also, how do we get them to be comfortable with our recommendation with something like how much in U.S. and how much in international? Well, after long conversations, we concluded that if we ask people to be 50-50 U.S. international, that they are going to go through periods where internationals don't perform well, and they're going to say, the heck with this. Why should I have money and half my money in international and miss all these great opportunities in the country I know and love? So our fear is they'll give up and they'll just go to what's comfortable. So we compromised. We compromised in those portfolios by using a 70% U.S. and a 30% international position. Sometimes that international position is 20% in large cap blend international and emerging markets. That, in fact, that's a very common thing to do because of what we have available. But then we run into another problem. We almost never get small cap international, let alone any small cap international value. So no blend, no value in the small cap. And yet we know that historically, there is a big advantage to having small cap in the portfolio. Now, we would love if that small cap were small cap value, but for some reason, small cap value is rarely chosen in these plans. So what we've done is we decided, okay, we're going to limit the exposure in the international market, and we're going to beef up the small cap. You see, normally we'd think about maybe if we only had the S&P 500 and the small cap, we might just divide that 50-50. But then we're not getting the exposure to small cap that we think will make a difference in the long run. And I'd like, you know, the fingers are crossed that eventually these plans will add small cap value, at which point we can go back and reevaluate and build a portfolio that's some combination of small cap value and small cap blend. But in the meantime, it is not unusual for us to end up putting 50% of the equity into the small cap asset class, 30% in the international, and that leaves 20% in the S&P 500. Now, we've still got the S&P, and oftentimes we have 30% in large cap international, but we've still got lots of large cap between the S&P 500 and the EAFE index, which is basically the S&P 500 internationally, the larger companies. So we have chosen to overweight in the U.S. to small cap because, one, we don't have it in the internationals. And so it is our way to try to kind of squeeze out the extra return for the risk that people are willing to take. Now, remember, the real risk you're going to be addressing inside that 401k is how much you put in fixed income. And so the difference in the worst of times, I mean, I can even look right now here at 2008. Let me look here and see how did the small cap do. The Russell 2000 in 2008 was down about 34%. The Russell 2000 value was down about 29%. The S&P growth was down about 34%. The S&P 500 was down about 37%. So in 2008, a year that you'd really be worried about, turned out that the small cap blend did better than the S&P 500. Now let's look back at 2000 through 2002. I see the S&P 500 in those 3 years were down 9, down 12, and down 22. The Russell 2000 was down 3, up 3, and down 20. So I'm not afraid of small cap doing something that is hugely different from the S&P 500. Yes, once in a while it will. I think I mentioned before that back in 1998, while the S&P 500 was up 28%, the small cap was down about 3%. So yes, there will be years that the S&P 500 will do better, but over the long term, I think that these folks who've got these limited strategies within their 401k, limited asset classes that are available, should try to expose themselves to that 50% in small cap, wish it could be small cap value, and the other 50% in basically in large cap. And again, lightening up on the international, just to give the investors more peace of mind when the U.S. is doing well. And by the way, the difference between having 50% in international and 30% is not a whole lot. It's going to be like a quarter of 1% probably. I don't remember the exact number, but a very small number. And now let me talk about another emotional decision. Trying to build a portfolio that is likely to, that investors can stay the course. And I've had a lot of people who were uncomfortable that we used the Guggenheim small cap value ETF over some of the others, that particularly when the Guggenheim had a bad year, it became uncomfortable. But let me tell you what we know about asset classes, big and small, and value and growth. We know that historically, you do get the best return by going to more deeply discounted value companies. Not always, but over the long term. We also know that smaller companies, so you have how discounted they are and how small they are. And the reason that we felt that the Guggenheim would serve people well was because the size of the company was very small, and they were deeply discounted. It was a, they call it the pure value. It's not easy to buy, to get anything that's pure, and they aren't as pure as 99.9% certainly, but they do represent, unfortunately, as comes along, like with the emerging markets we talked about earlier, a lot of volatility, a lot of time spent on the top, at the top, and a lot of time spent at the bottom of a group. And we've talked before, since the end of the year, about how the small cap value at DFA made considerably less than a Vanguard small cap value, where the average company at Vanguard was much larger and was not as deeply discounted. And I think people got that one, I think. But the fact is when we look at the Guggenheim ETF that represents small cap value, it has some big swings. It has periods of time, like 2009, the average small cap value ETF was up 26.5%. Guggenheim was up 62.7. 2013, Guggenheim up 45. I'm going to round off here. And the average up 36. 2016, Guggenheim up 34. The average 26. And then we have a year like 2017, where it underproduced. It was up 1.2. The average in the category was up 8.5. And then we had 2007, where Guggenheim was down 19, whereas the average was down 6. And Chris Patterson and I, we talked about it at length. What can we expect out of people? At what point do people break? How far do they have to underperform where they feel like the people who are giving them guidance have no idea what they're doing? By the way, I've spent a lot of my years in this industry being called crazy. In the late 90s, when I was trying to convince people to stay diversified, don't overweight your portfolio to high tech, people literally were emailing me and calling me crazy because I just felt like there was too much risk for the potential return. Well, once again, I don't want to be called crazy. It's not because I have an emotional thing about it. It's because I want you to be able to stay the course. So we made a change. If you look at the portfolio, it now has a spider S&P small cap value. And it's interesting to note that over a 10-year period, the compound rate of return of the Guggenheim is 11%. By the way, the average over that same period of time, ETFs, was 9.5. So it did just fine. The spider, in large part, got ahead because it had better performance in 2017. But the spider, the SLYV, was 11.6 for that period of time. They both outperformed the average by a considerable amount. And it may be that in the end, if people were willing to rebalance and remember that when you're in an asset class that's out of favor, like the S&P 500 was for years out of favor, some of those losses can get to be pretty big. And if you're in a similar asset class that is built to even have larger losses, it's easy to say, why the heck am I doing this? I did this to make money, not to lose. So rather than piling on, Chris and I came to the conclusion to bring the volatility of that particular asset class down to a level where more people will find it acceptable. And if you go through at Morningstar, you can do this, it's easy. If you go through and you look at SLYV and look at the performance page, you can look year by year at the average compared to the return of the particular ETF you're looking at. You could do that with Guggenheim, and you can do that with the Spider small cap value, S&P small cap value. And you will see that the SLYV runs closer to the average than RZV. RZV is generally way above or way below. But as I noted, the return over the period of time was fairly close. And if RZV has a good year this year, it could be that they'll be back even again. But in order to help people stay the course, we made a change. Now, you'll notice we didn't change to the 70-30 in the international versus U.S., or I'm sorry, U.S. versus international. We didn't go that far in making changes to make life easier for you, but we did have this make this one compromise. And now for the final topic on this particular podcast, I want to talk about my performance, our performance, the return that my wife and I got. We just to give you an overview, we're in our 70s and taking out 5% the first of each year. Would certainly like to be able to make a 6-7% compound rate of return over time. We oversaved so that we use a variable distribution strategy, which means at the first of the year, we take out 5% or whatever we got left at the end of the previous year. If it was a good year, we get a raise. If it's a bad year, we get a cut in pay because we're going to get 5% of whatever's left over. And this year, we got a raise because we had a good year last year. Most everybody who was in the market did have a good year last year. But we're not going to have as good a year as the S&P 500 because we don't want to be all equity. In fact, we don't even want to be the same as a buy and hold because we have half our portfolio in timing. Half of our portfolio is 70% equity, 30% fixed income with timing, which means that entire portfolio, almost the entire portfolio, can be in cash if the trend within the portfolio is down. And that's, by the way, looking at each and every fund that's in that portfolio, not looking at the trend of the whole portfolio. And what happened last year? Well, and I'm not going to give my return because my return is a little better than this because my fee is lower, but I see what the average of all the people who worked with Merriman was last year in that asset class. With timing, it was a 12% return after all fees. Fees at the funds, fees to Merriman. On the other hand, the similar risk in buy and hold is 50-50 stocks and bonds. Now, a lot of people think that timing is more risky than buy and hold. It, in fact, is not. That's not true in terms of volatility, because you can have the equity portion in cash in the timing account, and in the 50-50 buy and hold, you can't be in cash in the equity part of the portfolio. So how did it do last year? Well, I would have guessed that it would have made more than the timing account because generally speaking, in big bull markets, the buy and hold is going to do a little better than the market timing. We expect the timing to do better in the bad years. Let me give you an example of that. In the worst 12 months, going back back to 2000, the worst 12 months for the 70-30 was a loss of 18.4%. The worst 12 months for the 50-50 stock and bond with buy and hold was a loss of 24.8. Well, guess what time we're talking about? We're talking about 2008. And remember, the S&P 500 in 2008 was down 37, and a lot of the other asset classes were down in the 40s. So that 24.8% was not a catastrophic. In fact, the portfolio is built to have that kind. We expect to have that kind of loss, and guess what? We did. So I find this fascinating. The standard deviation of the 70-30 and the 50-50 are both 7.9. They're low. That's about half of what the S&P 500 would be. So last year, while the timing, 70-30, made 12, the buy and hold made 10.6. Again, that was 50-50. Why the lower return in the equity portion? Because value didn't do very well last year. We've talked about that before. And then there's the last 10% of my portfolio. It's our portfolio. It's 50% buy and hold. It's 40% what I'll call conservative timing. And then there's 10% that is what I call aggressive timing. It is a combination of timing and leverage, and it is under the umbrella of a hedge fund. And that account was up after fees last year 25%. So overall, my wife and I, happy as can be, up 12.6. Now that would assume that we were an average size account for the Merriman firm, and we're not. But we made a little more than that, but not enough to change our lifestyle. But it was a great year because we got more than twice what we took out for this year. And every year, we're getting closer and closer to the end, which means it becomes easier and easier. Even if we have a bad year, we know that we're well covered. So I don't know if that's of any interest to you, but I find this discussion of comparing buy and hold and timing interesting. You might say, well, if you have the same risk, and if you're going to get over 15 years, the returns are virtually the same for both of them. So that says a lot about the risk and the return. But why would I then, if the return is the same and the risk is the same, why would I want to have part of the portfolio with timing? And it's this. It's purely emotional. It's what I trust. If I had everything 50-50, buy and hold, that means that I must be willing to lose half of that 50% that's in equity without a fight, with no defense. Whereas with the timing, I have at least a hope and a prayer. Can't know that it will work. It has worked generally, never perfect, but it's worked generally since 1983 when I started doing this and built my business. Originally, it was timing only, and wasn't until the early 90s that we added buy and hold. And that included a period in 1987, by the way, when we were totally out of the market, when the market collapsed in October of 87. So there's a good side to timing. It's just that the bad is it's so difficult for people to do and to maintain. Buy and hold is tough enough for people that I know how much more difficult it is once you add the timing variable. I had a wonderful conversation today, actually two wonderful conversations. One with Daryl Balls, who is the fellow that works with us, donating his valuable time to this cause and to you. I talked with Daryl about how we are going to, changes we're going to make in the ultimate buy and hold strategy, how we present it. What we're going to do next in this regard. We're going to do the ultimate buy and hold table that we do every year. We're going to then go and update all the fine-tuning tables. After that, we're going to update the distribution tables. And then after that, we will share with you a new set of tables that reflect the implication of all of these returns during the period of accumulation. This year, I'll be doing a workshop here on Bainbridge that will be for accumulators only, for people who are building, and then I'm going to do another one for people who are in distribution. Those are two totally different parts of an investor's life, and so I look forward to doing those, and I'll be sharing a lot of that information on these podcasts. And then there's a conversation I had with Chris today. And what we talked about is what we're going to do at this year's National AAII Conference. When I say what we're going to do, we've got to give these folks some new information they haven't seen before. And I think we'll be doing something on the lifetime glide path. Doesn't matter whether you're just born or you're 80 years old, there is a glide path for the rest of your life, and we're going to be doing some studies on how to build that glide path, whether you're conservative, moderately aggressive, very aggressive, that choice is there to be made. And I think we've got some really interesting work coming out for you on this whole area of a glide path that would give you a better rate of return. And what we're looking for is something that is dirt simple, something that anybody could do, but would give them a chance to add an extra maybe 1 or 1.5% to their compound rate of return. So we're working on this for you, and hope you'll stick with us. Hope you'll share our work with others. And as always, thank you for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.